So let's continue our exploration of how Dogen sees studying the way with body and mind. I think we're starting to realize that when he says study, he really isn't saying anything different from what he calls practice realization. That practice and realization polarize, shall we say. And that body and mind are really two inextricably entwined aspects of our being. This is different from the dualistic understanding most of us grew up with in Western culture, the view that the body is somehow this mechanistic automaton of biochemical processes, and the mind is a manifestation of the immortal soul. This is different. This is different from that. So let's pick up where we left off. If you could find number 11 in the text. And is there someone willing to read that who hasn't read yet?
Because the study of the way is like this, walls, tiles, and pebbles are mind. Other than this, there are no three realms inseparable from mind, and no universe inseparable from mind. Mind is walls, tiles, and pebbles, put together, created before the Xiangtong era, and taken apart, destroyed after the Xiangtong era, 860 to 873. Splattered with mud and soaking wet. Finding the self with no rope, mind has the power to attract, extract a pearl, and the ability to enter the be a pearl in water. Some days the pearl is melted, sometimes it is crushed. There are times when this pearl is reduced to extremely fine powder.
Okay, thank you. So a lot of imagery here. Dogen's saying that mind is none other than the stuff of this everyday world. Walls, tiles, pebbles, and our interactions with everything around us. Nothing being separate from mind. This is why elsewhere he calls our practice all-inclusive. The footnote that I found about the before and after the Xiangtong era is kind of obscure. This was the era kind of the golden era of Chan or Zen in China. But the sense of it, of the before and after, is the sense of change over time. So we can connect that to walls and tiles being built up and crumbling. Human creations, right? Institutions built up and crumbling. And the mind, like that, always in flux. I really liked, when I first encountered this image of the walls and tiles being mined, I thought, I don't know. But then I remembered, and Michael and I traveled in China. We went across south and into southwestern China, very rural areas, over 30 years ago. And I remember how the color of the mud brick that the buildings were made of varied as you went through different landscapes. It was as though these villages had arisen right from the mud and were, at times, crumbling back into the mud. You know, you could really feel that this is a whole culture that grew out of this earth. And so that actually is kind of a potent image for our mind, you know? Coming into being, passing out of being, crumbling, changing form. All phenomena. Changing form. Like mud brick. Hmm. The translation's a little confusing here, so I, after looking at the Japanese and another translation, I'm going to venture to paraphrase this for you a little differently. The body, mind, living in this world, splattered with mud, soaking wet, with mindful self-restraint, has the power to enter the water and pull out the pearl of Dharma wisdom. Binding the self with no rope is an expression of mindful self-restraint. And then this ability to reach into the water, to reach into muddy water, right? And pull out the muddy water being our lives, our messy, messy lives, and pull out the Dharma pearl. Now that next line is a little ambiguous, because there's no subject in the Japanese language here. Some days, it says the pearl is melted. There's no subject. It just says some days it's melt it. There's not even it. Some days melted. Some days crushed. Sometimes crushed. Sometimes reduced to extremely fine powder. And I like actually this ambiguity because it means both the pearl and mind. Sometimes it dissolves, sometimes it crumbles, sometimes it's like fine powder. Even the pearl of Dharma wisdom is not something we can hang on to, nor is mind itself. So Dogen continues on in the next section in using this poetic language to describe that mutability of mind, seeing how deeply the impermanent nature of being can open what's often called the gateless gate, the gateless barrier. What feels like separation, what feels like a barrier, dissolves and we step through into boundlessness. So let's read that next one. Number 12, Bhatia?
Mind does not converse with bare outdoor pillars or rub shoulders with hanging lanterns. In this manner, the mind studies the way running barefoot. Who can get a glimpse of it? The mind studies the way turning somersault. All things stumbles over with it. At this time, a wall crumbling away allows you to study the 10 directions, and the gateless gate allows you to study the 4 quarters.
Okay, that's a little bit of a difficult passage. And here I forgot to, this morning I mentioned that there, in places where I think that, where I found that the translation was either too obscure or just off, or, you know, not a good word choice, I put an alternative, and I tried to put the alternative in bold, but here I didn't. And that the actual, when I looked at the character, it says outdoor pillars. I don't know exactly what an outdoor pillar is, but it makes more sense to me than a bare pillar. So, again, he's using concrete images of pillars and hanging lanterns. To somehow say that this study of the way with the mind is not a matter of subject and object. We're not relating to these things as objects, but a much more kind of dynamic relationship of self in world, with the things of the world. mutuality of changing and being changed by each other and things, other beings. He doesn't make so much distinction between the sentient and the insentient, the so-called insentient. These are all dynamic relationships. Okay, and the next thing he does is give us a lengthy passage about bodhicitta, which we talked about as the mind or the aspiration to awaken. The aspiration to awaken not just for ourselves, but for all beings. The mind of the bodhisattva. Okay, so number 13. Oh, Red Susan.
The aspiration for enlightenment can occur within birth and death, within nirvana. It can also occur without concern for birth and death in nirvana. It does not depend upon the place where it occurs, nor is it hindered by the place where it occurs. Conditions do not arouse it, and knowledge does not arouse it. The aspiration for enlightenment arouses itself. This arousing is the aspiration for enlightenment. The aspiration for enlightenment is neither existent nor non-existent, neither wholesome nor unwholesome, nor neutral. It is not the result of past actions. Even beings in the blissful realms can arouse it. The aspiration for enlightenment arises just at the time of arising. It is not limited by conditions.
So he's saying this aspiration to awaken doesn't depend on wholesomeness or unwholesomeness or the result of our past actions, and beings in any realm from the blissful realm to the miserable realms can have access, can actually give rise to the aspiration for enlightenment. He says it arouses itself. The aspiration for enlightenment arouses itself. Knowledge doesn't arouse it. Conditions don't arouse it. What on earth is he talking about? Let's read the next paragraph. That would be 14.
At the very moment when the aspiration for enlightenment is aroused, the entire world of phenomena arouses the aspiration for enlightenment. Although the aspiration for enlightenment seems to create conditions, it actually does not encounter conditions. The aspiration for enlightenment and conditions together hold out a single hand, held out freely, a single hand held out in the midst of all being. Thus, the aspiration for enlightenment is aroused even in the realms of hell, hungry ghosts, animals, and fighting spirits.
Okay, thank you. So these realms, the six realms, many of you have probably seen the wheel of life. At the bottom is the hell realm. It's often in Tibetan tankas, this representation of the wheel of life. The bottom is the hell realm, at the top is the heavenly realm, and over on this side is the realm of the hungry ghosts, and then the humans, and over here is the animals and the fighting spirits. And these classically would have been realms that individuals would be reborn into depending on their favorable or unfavorable karma. But I also think that these realms are really descriptive of the states that we can pass through in any given day or in even one zazen period. Right? They're very, very descriptive of some of our mind states. And each one has there's another whole talk that I have done about these realms. Each one has a kind of transformed quality. So he's really right in saying that that each of these realms has a way of turning and awakening. And in, you know, in the, he's playing here with the, what we call the two truths, the truth of the absolute and the truth of the relative. The relative is our everyday life, the realm of good and bad and of differentiation. And of course, in that realm of the relative, yeah, we do choose to raise up an aspiration to awaken. But he's talking in the absolute sense, and in the absolute sense, we could say we simply align with the reality that is there, the truth that all beings, the entire world of phenomena, arouse bodhicitta. It's been called the universe becoming conscious of itself. I don't know who said that, but. So sentient beings of all kinds in all realms are awakening, sort of a radically inclusive vision of consciousness. Which includes us. You know? We don't have to feel unworthy of taking up this practice. We don't have to say, oh, I can't take on these bodhisattva vows. I'm a terribly flawed human being. How can I vow to save all beings? How can I vow? But this is an alignment with realizing the interconnection that is already there.
Mm-hmm. He did not mention the heaven realm. Is it just implicitly included? You see that on the last sentence?
Yes.
He
actually mentioned the blissful realms up in the previous paragraph,
okay.
I think that's...
So implicitly, pretty much.
I think he's included. He left that out because he already said it.
Okay.
I think, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so all the realms. Yeah.
I just wanted to underline, I guess, that even in the bad ones, perceived as bad ones, it can happen.
Yeah, there's this place... And we can experience this in our practice. We can be... in a hell realm state. I mean, how many of you have sat in a hell realm state? I have. <right? laughs> Or in an animal realm state.
Oh yeah.
You know, strong desire arising, you know, or what, or a hungry ghost state of just deep, deep need and dissatisfaction, and you know, we all experience these states. And the fighting spirits, that's the competitive mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the mind that needs to beat out the next guy. Mm-hmm. It's very strong in our world, right? And the heavenly realm is the realm of ease and luxury and complacency. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to slip from that one down to one of the others, right? Mm-hmm. So, but each one of these, if you look at those images, Canon or Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, is in each one, a little canon in each one of those realms, giving the gift that can turn that state into awakening. Mm. So it's really quite a beautiful vision, you know, and a very inclusive, all-inclusive vision. None of us are left out. Okay. How about number 15? Somebody else want to read? Jump in, please. Yeah, Ben.
Bits and pieces of straightforward naked mind means all the bits and pieces, moment after moment, are straightforward naked mind. Not only one or two pieces, but all bits and pieces. The lotus leaf is completely round, round as a mirror. The tip of the water chestnut is extremely sharp, sharp as a gimlet. Although straightforward naked mind resembles a mirror, it is bits and pieces. Even if it resembles a gimlet, it is bits and pieces.
Okay. So, does anybody not know what a gimlet is? I didn't even look it up, but isn't a gimlet something that, it's sort of like a extremely sharp thing that you would poke through leather if you were a leather worker, for example. Isn't it Gimlet like an awl?
I think it is. I think it's a long, thin tool of some kind.
It's some kind of tool. I can't tell you exactly what it's used for.
I don't know if it's for leatherwork, though.
No, but I think it's like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's imagine it that way.
A piercing tool.
Okay. So this phrase, bits and pieces of naked mind, is quite interesting, I found. In Japanese, it's sekishin henpen. So sekishin consists of the characters for red and the one we looked at, heart mind, that's in the title of the shinjin. That's red. That's the heart, and it would be red. So red, heart mind. That's sekishin. Red is used to refer to flesh, so it means naked or bare. And little babies in Japanese are called akachan, little red. Well, they are, kind of. For some of them. little red one. So sekishin means naked mind, sort of stripped of obstructions. Almost, we could also imagine it almost as innocent mind, childlike mind, without the masks of conditioning. And henpen is not a chicken coop. It's a compound with two of the same characters. It just, the second one becomes pen because it's attached to the first one. They're both actually hen, and they are shards or fragments. So when you put them together, it means multiple shards and fragments. So that's why he says bits and pieces, but it also has the sense of moments in time, fragments in time. So what this becomes is this kind of bare mind, moment by moment, is the sense of that phrase. And within each moment of awareness, the particularity of being is perceived in that moment. The roundness of the lotus leaf, the pointed sharpness of the chestnut tip, and the particularity of your human experience in that moment, with its roundness and sharpness, its gimpy knee, or flat feet, or curly hair. That's sekishin henpen. Right. Just this body mind right now. Okay, could someone read number 16 for me? Jacob.
As for the mind of ancient Buddhas, a monk once asked Huizong, national teacher at Dazen, "What is the mind of ancient Buddhas?" Huizong said, "Walls, tiles, and pebbles." Thus, know that the mind of the ancient Buddhas is not merely walls, tiles, and pebbles, and that walls, tiles, and pebbles are not merely called the mind of the ancient Buddhas. The mind of the ancient Buddhas is studied in this way.
So here he is with walls, tiles, and pebbles again. Reiterating his earlier point that the mind of ancient Buddhas both is and is not walls, tiles, and Buddhas. Pebbles.
He's not referring here to the time of those ancestors that got enlightened by pebbles or a finger or mallet or whatever?
He could be, but I don't think that's that he's referring to specific stories. I think that the mind of the ancient Buddhas like ours, is engaged with the everyday things of the world. Yeah, and it is that actual engagement. And in certain cases,
when the mind is cleansed, and he's talking before that about naked mind, actually what I thought that he's talking about this process that even the ancient Buddha had to go through until they got enlightened. I mean, they got enlightened by pebble, by
yeah, that's stroke, I think what I
yeah.
said
okay.
is that just like us, the ancient
that's right.
Buddhas
yeah.
awaken through their actual embodied experience with yeah. the things of the world. Yeah. Whether it's a pebble, in one case hitting a bamboo and hearing that sound.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this is why we call our practice everyday Zen. Yeah. Mm. It's right here in front of us. It's what we meet when we walk out that door, or in this door. Okay, more about everyday mind, number 17. Megan?
Everyday mind means to maintain everyday mind in this world or in any world. Yesterday goes forth in this moment, and today comes forth from this place. While going, the boundless sky goes, and while coming, the entire earth comes. This is everyday mind. Everyday mind opens the gate of the inner chamber, because thousands of gates and myriads of doors open and close all at once. It is everyday mind. Now, this boundless sky and entire earth are like unrecognized words, a voice from the deep. Words are all-inclusive. Mind is all-inclusive. Things are all-inclusive.
So this everyday mind is key, really, to practice in our tradition. You know, those doors and gates are boundless. They're all around. They're myriad. And we step through them all the time. There is this everyday mind is key to a koan in the Gateless Gate collection called Mumonkan, or Gateless Barrier. We studied it over the practice period this past fall with our Shuso Todd over here. And I believe you did this when you gave a talk on this one, Todd, did you? It's about Nanchuan, Zen master Nanchuan, and his disciple Zhaozhou, who later became a great teacher himself. And Zhaozhou asks Nanchuan, what is the way? Nanchuan replies, everyday mind is the way. Right? Zhaozhou asks, how should I direct myself toward it? Right? That's what we all want, right? And Nanchuan replies, if you direct yourself toward it, you will be going in the wrong direction. So Zhaozhou says, but if I don't direct myself, how can I know it? And Nanchuan said, the way has nothing to do with knowing and not knowing. Knowing is an exaggeration. Not knowing is stupidity. So you don't get away with trying to hold on either way. If you're trying to hold on to knowing, you've already distorted it. Mm. You've distorted it.
Yep.
If you try to hold on to not knowing, you're just going to be stupid and walk out in front of a bus. He continues, when you enter the way, you see it as vast and boundless as space. What does this have to do with yes and no thinking? Mm. So that's a key. In fact, that koan in our tradition, during practice period, there's a person who is the practice leader who steps forward to serve the Sangha in that way. And some of you, Susan has been, Todd was this past. And at the end of the practice period, during our sesshin, our week-long retreat, at the very end, there's a ceremony where each person asks the Shuso a question, and they have to respond just like that to each question. And right before the questions come, the Shuso reads this everyday Zen koan. Mm-hmm. So this is one you'll hear over and over again. But this is the dilemma we all face in our practice, right? If we strive to achieve something that we think is enlightenment, we'll miss the mark. If we think we've grasped the absolute, we've already misrepresented it. But if we stay stuck in a notion of emptiness as blank or static, we won't be able to respond to the world around us. You know, we have to live in the world. But when we fully enter the gateless gate, in any moment, the way is boundless. We can respond. Okay, one more paragraph. 18, somebody? Yeah, Greg.
Although there is birth and death in each moment of this life of birth and death, the body after the final body is never known. Even though you do not know it, if you arouse the aspiration for enlightenment, you will move forward on the way of enlightenment. The moment is already here. Do not doubt it in the least. Even if you should doubt it, this is nothing but everyday life.
So, even though birth and death are happening all around us, all the time, inside us, right? All those little cells and microorganisms are living and dying right inside us all the time. But we don't know what happens after death. Here Dogen says we can't know the body after the final body. Like the Buddha, he discourages metaphysical speculation. The Buddha didn't like to give people a concrete answer to those metaphysical questions. He said, you know, I'm about teaching how to live in this world of suffering. The moment of awakening is right here, right now. Do not doubt it in the least. And because, of course, he knows we will doubt, he says, even if you do doubt it, meet your doubt as another moment of everyday mind. Subject, causes, and conditions. I love that, where he says, even if you should doubt it, this is nothing but everyday mind. I find this deeply encouraging. And I hope you do too. And I want to, while you're doing the next thing, I'm going to look at the Japanese for that word, that expression of
without doubt.
Not doubting, yeah. So that's all I'm going to say for my talk. And what I'd like to encourage you to do is to scan back over the passages we've just read, or if you want to go back earlier to this morning's, that's fine too. Mm-hmm. Just take a pen and mark anything that sort of resonates for you. Mm-hmm. And then after you do that for a while, pick a passage or a part of a passage and write it in your own words. Do your version. You can update the images. You know, you can play around with this. Have some fun with Dogen. It's okay. But use concrete images. You know, don't be abstract and philosophical. Bring this into everyday Zen. Okay, so but first just go through and see where there's some spark for you. Okay?